The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the May 28th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows looks like a mother and daughter. We see them from the back. They're walking across the parking lot. Looks like they're about to go into a Walmart. And in the foreground is a trash can that is just stuffed to overflowing. And all you see is masks, face masks, just pouring over and spilling over onto the sidewalk. The headline is Mask Confusion. Was the CDC's about-face on indoor protection premature? That is one of our main stories, and we'll start right there. CDC lifts mask rules for vaccinated Americans. What happened? Many Americans took off their face masks last week after the Centers for Disease Control scrapped almost all of its masking and social distancing recommendations for people fully vaccinated against COVID-19, an unexpected announcement that was met with celebration and confusion. Citing new research that indicates recipients of Pfizer's and Moderna's shots are highly unlikely to spread the virus or to be infected by variants, the CDC said vaccinated people can safely go without masks in almost all situations, even when they are indoors in large groups. The advisory, an abrupt about-face for an agency that just 3 weeks earlier had urged vaccinated people to remain masked in crowded spaces, surprised even the White House. "We'll smile again," President Biden said on receiving the news. "And now, see one another smile." Within a day, some 20 states had lifted mask mandates for vaccinated residents. Walmart, Trader Joe's, Costco, Publix, Target, Starbucks, and other businesses also dropped mask requirements for inoculated customers. Real-world data suggests the vaccines are working remarkably well. At the peak of the pandemic in January, COVID was killing more than 3,300 Americans a day. That figure is now down to about 600. While the U.S. vaccination campaign has slowed from an April high of 3.5 million shots administered daily to 1.8 million now, about 158 million Americans have received at least one dose, and nearly half of U.S. adults are fully vaccinated, including 70% of seniors. Many health officials and doctors said the CDC's announcement was premature and could undercut one of their most effective tools for battling the coronavirus, which is still infecting about 35,000 people a day. The guidance shifts all the burden onto individuals to be on their honor, said Johns Hopkins University epidemiologist Lisa Marigakis. The likely result is almost no one will wear a mask. What the editorial said: "Don't toss out your face mask and rush out on the town just yet," said the Los Angeles Times. For starters, the CDC guidance is full of exceptions. It doesn't extend to prisons, schools, hospitals, trains, planes, or businesses that require face coverings. So much for getting back to normal. Then there's the fact that only one-third of Americans are fully vaccinated, and there's no way to know if the maskless people near you in a restaurant or store have had their shots. There's still a risk, albeit a low one, of sparking new infections when you gather unvaccinated and unmasked people in a room and let them mix. Eradication of the coronavirus was never and still cannot be the goal, said WashingtonExaminer.com. We don't demand that other risks be reduced to zero at any cost, and the same is true with COVID. The CDC's new advisory is an overdue recognition of the reality that, thanks to vaccines, we have defeated the epidemic. It's over. Now it's time to take the next steps. Classrooms need to open in full. We should lift capacity limits at ballparks, theaters, and places of worship where the community spread is low, which is almost all of the country. What the columnists said. The CDC's guidance has caused a giant mess, said Dr. Lena Wynn in the Washington Post. The announcement blindsided governors and mayors, leading to a confusing patchwork of new mask rules across the country, and it left businesses scrambling to find ways to relax restrictions while also protecting the unvaccinated. A scientific agency like the CDC is not equipped to steer policy, so Biden needs to course correct now. His administration should define region-by-region criteria for lifting mask mandates, perhaps when 70% of the community is vaccinated, and help private entities set up apps that people can use to prove their vaccination status. Democrats who once demanded that everyone follow the science are now aghast that the CDC is doing just that, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy reacted to the agency's advisory as though it was a display of pure madness and vowed to keep his state's indoor mask mandate, while Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot pledged that masks would stay on in her city until she received clarification from the CDC. For liberals, face coverings have become a tribal identifier and a sign of righteousness, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. They won't give them up any more readily than they will Subarus or Whole Foods. The CDC's mask guidance depends on people being truthful and considerate, said Julia Bosman and Sarah Mervosh in the New York Times. But the pandemic has exposed how little trust there is between red and blue America. We've witnessed screaming crowds protesting lockdowns, strangers growling at one another about social distancing, and infuriating stories of vaccine line jumping. Now Americans are being asked to lower their guard and accept that every maskless person is fully vaccinated. Michigan resident Tori Saylor, who is immunocompromised, says she isn't ready to make that assumption. How can I judge whether someone is vaccinated by making momentary eye contact with them? Our controversy of the week is January 6th. Should a bipartisan commission investigate? Hey, remember that January 6th attack on the Capitol? Said Bess Levin in Vanity Fair. Republicans would prefer that you didn't. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy this week reversed himself and called on the GOP caucus to reject a proposed bill brokered by McCarthy's own negotiators for a 9/11-style bipartisan commission to investigate the attempted insurrection. The bill was expected to pass the House anyway and head to the Senate, where Minority Leader Mitch McConnell quickly declared his opposition. To be fair, some Republicans said, a commission should also probe left-wing political violence, such as the rioting in Portland. If that excuse sounds transparently absurd, consider the efforts of House Republicans last week to rewrite history about the deadly assault, which left five dead and 138 Capitol Police officers injured. Representative Paul Gozer of Arizona described the rioters as peaceful patriots, while Representative Andrew Clyde of Georgia likened the violent insurrection to a normal tourist visit. Do tourists break down doors and windows, drag officers down steps and bash them with flagpoles and bats, and prowl the Capitol hallway shouting, "Where's Nancy?" and "Hang Mike Pence?" The GOP is now trying to memory hole one of the darkest days in modern American history, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. It all speaks to just how low the party has stooped in its worship of the former president. GOP leaders may not be principled, but they are playing it smart, said Harry Enten in CNN.com. They're poised to recapture the House and perhaps the Senate in next year's midterms if they can just turn out their 2020 base and a little more. To join Democrats in an investigation of January 6 would endanger that prospect by incensing Trump and the 70% of Republican voters who agree with him that the election was stolen. Democrats want a commission to damage the GOP and protect their own hold on power, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Their goal is to buttress their narrative that January 6 was a planned attempted coup. With no chance of a fair-minded inquiry, why should Republicans play ball? That's rather rich, given that Republicans staged 10 congressional investigations into the deaths of 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But now McCarthy thinks we don't need even one probe into how a defeated U.S. president enlisted a violent mob to try to cancel an election because he lost. Congressional Republicans have good reason to fear a thorough investigation, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. The ugly truth is that many were all in with Trump's effort to overturn the election. McCarthy also does not want to testify about his mid-riot phone call to Trump, pleading with the then-president to call off his supporters. Trump reportedly told him, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." The GOP is minimizing January 6 for 2 disgraceful reasons, said Fred Hyatt in the Washington Post, to preserve the big lie of the stolen 2020 election, and to give cover for actions that in 2024 could turn the big lie into the big steal. That's why Republican state legislatures are proposing and passing bills designed not only to suppress the Democratic vote, but also to let those legislators override election officials, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. These laws will enable state legislatures to refuse to certify Democratic victories. In 2020, Trump's rolling coup attempt didn't succeed, but it revealed how to rig the system for the next time. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for national service after a UK finance firm estimated that the nation's hospitality sector can recoup its pandemic losses if every citizen of legal drinking age performs the basic duty of every British adult and consumes 124 pints of beer this summer. It was a good week for Newark, New Jersey, which was named one of the top 10 barbecue cities in the U.S. by an Australian food blog that did not include any city in Georgia, Mississippi, or Texas. And it was a good week for ill-gotten gains, with the news that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was paid $5.12 million for American Crisis, his memoir about the pandemic. The book stopped selling amid allegations that Cuomo sexually harassed female underlings, hid nursing home deaths, and used staff on the state payroll for work on the book. It was a bad week for lesser included offenses. After a Colorado man charged with murdering his wife was also charged with stealing her mail-in ballot and using it to vote for Donald Trump. "I figured all these other guys are cheating," Barry Lee Morphew allegedly told FBI agents. It was a bad week for flashbacks, with reports of increasing neutron levels in radioactive waste at the abandoned Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine. Ukraine's Institute for Safety Problems of Nuclear Power Plants warned, "We can't rule out the possibility of another accident." And finally, it was a bad week for creative defensives. After Albert Watkins, lawyer for QAnon shaman Jacob Chansley, said that most of those who stormed the Capitol on January 6 are short bus people with brain damage who were subjected to 4-plus years of GD propaganda, the likes of which the world has not seen since effing Hitler. Wow. So let's move on to the briefing. Boycotting the 2022 Olympics. Human rights activists are calling for the U.S. to boycott the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Will that happen? Why is China hosting? In a controversial decision, the International Olympic Committee voted 44-40 in 2015 to award the 2022 Winter Olympics to China. China won partly because a number of cities had withdrawn from the bidding, including Stockholm, Sweden, and Oslo, Norway, citing the cost and lack of interest by their citizens. Beijing views its selection as a major opportunity to promote China's image as a world power rivaling the U.S. But activists are calling for the U.S. to lead a boycott of the competition. The outcry stems primarily from China's treatment of the Muslim Uyghur minority, which the Trump and Biden administrations have labeled as genocide. Since 2017, an estimated 1 million Uyghurs in western Xinjiang region have been detained without trial in indoctrination camps. Men and women have been subjected to horrific abuses, including torture, rape, forced labor, sterilization, and political indoctrination, with demands they abandon their Muslim religion. Human Rights Watch has denounced China's treatment of the Uyghurs as crimes against humanity. Tensions have also ratcheted up over recent Chinese cyber attacks on the U.S., crackdowns on pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong, and aggression against Taiwan. The Chinese government has warned of a robust response if Washington opts to boycott. Have there been previous Olympic boycotts? They are actually not that uncommon. In 1956, several nations skipped the games in response to the Soviet Union's actions in Hungary, while Egypt, Iraq, and Lebanon boycotted the summer games in Melbourne, Australia, because of British and French involvement in the Suez Crisis. In 1958, 6 years after it sent its first Olympic delegation, the People's Republic of China withdrew from the IOC following the committee's decision to let Chinese and Taiwanese athletes compete under separate flags. China continued to boycott the Games until 1980, the same year that the U.S. and 65 other countries boycotted the Summer Games in Moscow. Why did the U.S. boycott in 1980? President Jimmy Carter called for a boycott of the Moscow Games in response to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan that winter. Public support for the boycott eroded after the U.S. hosted the 1980 Winter Games at Lake Placid, New York, and its men's hockey team famously upset the Soviets on way to claiming the gold medal. That victory buttressed the argument that it would prove more embarrassing to Moscow for the U.S. to compete against the Russians and beat them. But in the end, 65 nations boycotted, including the U.S. team. In retaliation, the Soviets sat out the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles. Who supports a boycott in 2022? More than 180 human rights groups are leading the calls to skip the event over China's aggressive actions against Tibet, Taiwan, the Uyghur community, and Hong Kong. A survey by the Chicago Council in March found that 49% of Americans support a boycott, with 46% opposed. Senator Mitt Romney, who was president of the 2002 Salt Lake City Games, has called a boycott the easy but wrong answer. Romney said that our athletes have trained their entire lives for this competition, and they shouldn't be the ones to shoulder the burden of our disapproval. What is President Biden's position? A State Department spokesman said last month that a boycott was something that we certainly wished to discuss, but the department later walked back those remarks. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that we are not discussing a boycott with allies. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee has also urged the U.S. not to hold out, saying the more effective course of action would be to engage China directly on human rights issues. Not surprisingly, most athletes want to compete. And IOC President Thomas Bach said history shows that boycotts never achieve anything. Why would you punish the athletes from your own country if you have a dispute with a government from another country, Bach said. But U.S. skiing star Michaela Schifrin criticized the IOC for giving China the opportunity to host an event that's supposed to bring the world together and create hope and peace. Are there alternatives? If the U.S. still decides to send its athletes, corporations that normally sponsor the Olympics could pull their support. The top American sponsors, including Airbnb, Coca-Cola, General Electric, and Visa, collectively pay over $1 billion for exclusive rights to include the Olympics rings in their promotions. Some opponents of the boycott argue that athletes could use the world stage to raise awareness about China's human rights abuses. Sprinters John Carlos and Tommy Smith created one of the most powerful images in Olympic history by raising their fist in a Black Power salute on the medal stand in 1968. If American athletes go to Beijing, it's possible we could see something just as memorable. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with one from the U.S. from Andrew Sullivan, the GOP's road back to power. The GOP is flubbing one of its biggest political opportunities in years, said Andrew Sullivan. In the U.K. and other Western countries, conservative parties are winning elections by combining populist economic policies with a strong defense of traditional values against a radical left assault. Instead, Republicans are aligning themselves with the broadly toxic figure of Donald Trump. To win back Trump voters alienated, and Democrats are turning off the wokeism, Republicans should go left on economics and right on culture. On economics, that means limiting the power of monopolistic corporations and spreading the wealth to the working class. On culture, it means affirming love of our flawed but idealistic country, enforcing the nation's borders with firmness and compassion, and embracing colorblind policies on race rather than Democrats' demands for racial equity. Even now, the GOP stands poised to take back the House in 2022, and could claim the Senate too, and the White House in 2024, if it chooses leaders less toxic to suburban moderates than Trump and his acolytes. A Republican Party that stood for hard work, traditional values, and individual opportunities would be very popular and could create a genuine realignment. The next two columns are on the international page, and they are perspectives, one first from Israel and then from the Palestinians about the ongoing conflict there. So first, Israel hit by riots and rockets. The Israeli government has been caught completely off guard, said Ron Ben Yashia. After weeks of rising tension over attempts to evict Palestinian families from East Jerusalem homes and clashes between police and Arab protesters around Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest shrine in Islam, it was inevitable that Hamas would join the fray in the supposed name of Palestinian solidarity. The Islamist group did just that last week, firing thousands of rockets from across Gaza toward Tel Aviv and central Israel. Those missiles were accurate to a degree Israel had never imagined. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should have been prepared for this assault, but our leaders have spent more than 2 years solely focused on themselves and their power. We've had four inconclusive elections since 2019 and have neglected the Palestinian issue and rising anger among Israeli Arabs. Now everything is blowing up in their faces. The fighting is coming to resemble an actual civil war, said Ruthie Bloom in the Jerusalem Post. Arab mobs in Israeli cities have set fire to synagogues and Jewish stores, while Jewish mobs have pulled Arabs from their cars and beaten them. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who controls the West Bank, helped fuel this violence. He spread the lie that Israel intended to take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Abbas' aim was to spark an uprising, giving him an excuse to cancel the upcoming Palestinian elections that his Fatah party was sure to lose to Hamas. He succeeded in postponing the vote, but Hamas stole his thunder. There's something suspicious about the timing of this conflict, said Adam Raz in Haaretz. Having failed to muster a government coalition after the March election, Netanyahu was just a few days from being ousted from office. Did he instruct police to crack down hard on Palestinian protesters, knowing that Hamas would obligingly start lobbing missiles, allowing Netanyahu to play the role of strong wartime leader? Hamas and Netanyahu have certainly had a long symbiotic relationship. The prime minister needs the jihadist group to undercut Abbas' authority, because with Hamas, there's no talk about a negotiated solution to the conflict. Hamas, meanwhile, likes that Netanyahu has turned a blind eye to the cash-filled suitcases that keep arriving in Gaza from Qatar. It's absurd that much of the world views Israel as the bad guy in this lockdown, said Ron Torresain in Arutz Shiva. Hamas hurls rockets indiscriminately at our cities, while Israel strikes judiciously, always warning first. Yet because we have the Iron Dome anti-missile system, we incur far fewer casualties. Hamas, meanwhile, hides its munitions in civilian buildings, so when Israel targets them, there are sometimes civilian casualties. The result is that photographs of bleeding Palestinian children are beamed around the globe, and the world sides with Hamas, effectively attacking a democracy for protecting herself from a terrorist organization. Evidently, the world would rather have more Jews die, because that would even the score. Too bad. Israel will not apologize for defending itself. The Palestinians, an explosion of rage. Israel is entirely to blame for its bloody new conflict with the Palestinians, said Baria Alamuddin in Arab News. Israeli authorities chose the holy month of Ramadan to use their fig leaf of a justice system to seek the eviction of six Palestinian families from their homes in East Jerusalem, where they have lived for some 70 years. It was yet another of the racist land grabs meant to throttle Palestinians out of existence in their own capital. Some 20,000 Palestinian homes throughout the city are currently under threat of demolition. This is the very definition of ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The evictions are only one source of anger, said Palestinian writer Muhammad Shahada in Haaretz. In recent weeks, Arab Israelis have been beaten by police for daring to protest against far-right Jewish groups that marched through Jerusalem chanting "Death to Arabs" and attacking Palestinian passersby. When Israeli police raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem last week because Palestinians were stockpiling stones there in anticipation of more clashes with authorities and far-right Jewish nationalists, Hamas had to respond with rockets or be judged irrelevant by the Palestinian street. Where are our Arab brethren when we are under attack? Asked Ghazi Abu Dhaka. There is no room for any justification for those who refrain from jihad. We are finally striking the Zionists in their cities, as they have long bombed ours, and our brave warriors in Gaza could destroy Israel once and for all if they were joined by forces from Lebanon and Syria in the north, from Iran and Iraq in the east and Yemen in the south. Arab leaders won't help, said Majid al-Zibdeh. The United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Morocco, and Bahrain actually made peace with the Zionist occupiers last year under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. We Palestinians are on our own. But Israeli Arabs, Gazans, and West Bank residents are united in supporting the armed resistance. The corrupt Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is a puppet of the Israelis. Hamas is the undisputed legitimate leader of all the Palestinian people. Israel cannot claim the high moral ground, said Palestinian journalist Marwan Bishara. Having driven Palestinians from their homes in 1948 and occupied more territory in subsequent wars, it bears the sin of a state founded on the ruin of another people. That means there can be no good outcome for Israel. When the dust settles on another sadistic Israeli war, Israelis will again find themselves faced with millions of Palestinians ever more determined to regain their liberty. Time for The Last Word, our feature article, titled this week, A Stowaway at 35,000 Feet. Climbing into an airplane's wheel well is a feat of almost unimaginable desperation, said Siren Kale in The Guardian. It leads to freezing and oxygen deprivation, yet incredibly, some stowaways survive. It was Sunday, June 30th, 2019, a balmy summer's afternoon, and Will, a 31-year-old software engineer, was lounging on an inflatable airbed outside his house in southwest London. He wore pajamas and drank Polish beer. As he chatted to his housemate in the sunshine, planes on their way to Heathrow Airport made their final approach overhead. On his phone, Will showed his housemate an app that tells users the route and model of any passing plane. He tested the app on one plane and then held his phone up again, shielding his eyes from the sun and squinting into the sky. Then he saw something falling. At first I thought it was a bag, he said, but after a few seconds it turned into quite a large object and it was falling fast. Maybe a piece of machinery had fallen from the landing gear, he thought, or a suitcase from the cargo hold. But then he half remembered an article he had read years before about people stowing away on planes. He didn't want to believe it, but as the object got nearer and nearer, it became impossible to deny. In the last second or two of it falling, I saw limbs, said Will. I was convinced that it was a human body. Will took a screenshot of the flight app notification, and his housemate called the police to give them the details. Kenya Airways flight KQ-100, a Boeing 787-8 Dreamliner that had left Nairobi's Jomo Kenyatta International Airport 8 hours and 6 minutes earlier at 9:35 local time. Will turned out to be right. It was a body. He had plummeted 3,500 feet, half frozen, hitting the ground at 3:38 p.m. He was the man who fell from the sky. The body landed on Offerton Road, 1,000 feet from Will's house. Police contacted Heathrow, which dispatched staff to examine the Kenya Airways plane's wheel wells, the unpressurized area into which the plane's landing gear retracts after takeoff. Inside, staff found a grubby khaki rucksack with the initials MCA written on it. The rucksack didn't contain any significant clues, just some bread, a bottle of Fanta, a bottle of water, and a pair of trainers. Stowing away in the wheel well of a passenger jet is a suicidally dangerous thing to do. According to the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, from 1947 to February 2020, 128 people around the world attempted to stow away in this manner. More than 75% of them died. This is not surprising. At every stage, imminent death is all but assured. The stowaway may fall out of the plane as it is taking off. If he survives takeoff, he can be crushed by the landing gear as it retracts into the wheel well. If he avoids that too, he will probably die shortly after. Within about 25 minutes of takeoff, most passenger planes reach a cruising altitude of 35,000 feet. The temperature outside the plane is approximately minus 65 Fahrenheit, although the hydraulic lines used to extend and retract the landing gear emit heat, raising the temperature by as much as 35 degrees. Still, minus 30 is cold enough to induce fatal hypothermia. The air pressure at cruising altitude is around four times lower than sea level, which means that a person's lungs cannot draw sufficient oxygen from the air. This will lead to hypoxia when the blood is not able to supply enough oxygen to the tissues of the body, which can cause heart attacks and brain death. And yet, what is truly extraordinary, given the risks involved, is that some stowaways do survive. Something happens that we don't fully understand, said Paulo Alves in the UK's Aerospace Medical Association. Their best guess about how some stowaways cheat death? They hibernate. Stephen Verano, the world's leading expert on wheel well stowaways, outlined this theory in a 1996 paper for the Federal Aviation Administration. The person's core body temperature can fall to 27 Celsius, about 81 degrees Fahrenheit, or even lower. When the plane lands, a gradual rewarming occurs, along with reoxygenation, to be frozen and come back to life. It is fantastical, and yet it seems to be true. The Kenya Airways stowaway case would normally have been one for the London Police's Missing Persons Unit, but the team was swamped. So Deputy Sergeant Paul Graves of the Specialist Crime Unit volunteered. In his three-decade career as a police officer, Graves had worked on stabbings, shootings, kidnappings, and attempted murders. Graves hoped to identify the fallen man and repatriate his body, but he wasn't optimistic. In September 2019, Graves flew to Kenya, hoping to uncover any information that might help identify the stowaway. He visited slums around the airport and mortuaries, which were full of unclaimed bodies. The airport's CCTV recordings of the departure gate and runway show that nobody jumped on the plane as it was taking off, and nobody climbed into the undercarriage while it was at gate 17. That means the stowaway almost certainly boarded the plane earlier, as the plane waited in an area where CCTV coverage was less clear. From a physical perspective, getting on the plane wouldn't have been difficult. To access the wheel well, you have to shimmy about 6 feet up to the landing gear. It is covered in struts, making it easy to get a foothold, and crawl into the cavity that the wheels retract into after takeoff. The hard part would have been gaining access to the aircraft before takeoff. Security at Jomo Kenyatta International was tight. There was no evidence of any obvious security breaches, said Graves. All the staff had to use passes to go through secure gates. For the people who run airports, stowaways are embarrassing, dangerous, and often lead to demands for expensive security upgrades. For Kenyan authorities, there may have been an additional concern. In 2017, Jomo Kenyatta International Airport received a Category 1 security classification, permitting direct flights to the U.S. By the end of 2019, Kenyan officials had wrapped up their investigation, and no breach had been found at Jomo Kenyatta International. It retained its Category 1 security status. For Graves, though, the story was always bigger than how the stowaway made it on the plane. The question was why. We saw the aftermath of someone falling from an airplane, said Graves. But for me, the interesting part was, where did the story start? Since the earliest days of aviation, there have been stowaways. People from countries such as Cuba, South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, and China have secretly climbed onto planes in the hopes of leaving their old life behind. They abscond for all kinds of reasons: poverty, unhappiness, boredom, despair. Boss Wee, the 12-year-old who stowed away in a Douglas DC-3 from Indonesia to Australia in 1946, was an orphan who worked for food in the kitchens of Kupang Airport in West Timor. A teenager who flew in the wheel well of a Boeing 767 from California to Hawaii said he was trying to get back to his mother in Somalia. Every known wheel well stowaway has been male. The youngest documented was a boy of 9. Cuba is the most common country of origin for wheel well stowaways, with 9 cases since 1947. Armando Socarras Ramirez was the first. In June 1969, when he was 17, Ramirez hid in the right wheel well of a Douglas DC-8 that was due to make the 8-hour flight from Havana to Madrid. Upon landing, the pilot found Ramirez lying under the plane, covered in ice, not breathing. "The doctors in Spain called me the popsicle," Ramirez told me recently. He is now 69, a father of 4 and grandfather of 12, and lives in Virginia. Ramirez got the idea to stow away from his friend Jorge Perez Blanco, who was a year younger. Together, they staked out the Havana airport. "The only airline suitable was Iberia," Ramirez said, "because the rest were going to communist countries. If we'd landed there, they'd have sent us right back, maybe in the same wheel well." The Iberia Airlines flight from Madrid landed on a Tuesday morning, refueled, and departed on Tuesday evening. On June 3, 1969, Ramirez and Perez waited outside the perimeter fence. Ramirez carried a rope, flashlight, and cotton wool to stuff in his ears. As the plane began to taxi down toward the runway, they jumped the fence. Perez started to have second thoughts, and Ramirez half-dragged him to the plane. The engines were roaring madly. They approached from the rear. Perez, who shortly after fell out of the plane and was found alive on the runway, entered the left wheel well, and Ramirez the right. The plane took off. "When the plane got up in the air," Ramirez says, "the compartment started opening up to let the wheels come inside. I was hanging on with my fingertips to the edge of the compartment and being blown sideways by the wind. Inside the wheel well, it was black and deafening. You became part of the noise. It made me shake. I put some cotton wool in my ears, but it didn't work. When you become the noise, it's beyond comprehension," he said. But wedged into the corner of the compartment, Ramirez felt overjoyed. "I was content," he said, "because I made it." He leaned against the tires, which were hot to the touch, but cooled down quickly as the temperature in the wheel well plunged. "It was very, very freezing," he said, "and I was shivering and shaking." He passed out, and his next memory is of waking up underneath the plane in Madrid before he blacked out again. Paramedics were called. Staff carried him into the airport and left him on the ground, thinking he was dead. Then he came to. "I saw people around me, and the room was moving around like I was dizzy," he said. "Everything was moving. The walls were moving, and the lights were moving from side to side." Ramirez spent the next 52 days recovering in the hospital. At first, he was unable to hear anything. The staff had to communicate with him using a chalkboard. But after a month, his hearing returned. "Incredibly," he said, "he has suffered no long-term health consequences. My blood pressure is normal. My heartbeat is normal," he said. He worked as a firefighter for 11 years. Ramirez has only one regret. "After me in Cuba, a lot of youngsters tried to do what I did," he said, "and most of them died." We still do not know the identity of the man who fell to the earth on June 30th, 2019. All we know, or think we know, are the last things he would have seen and heard. The grunt and hiss of hydraulics inside the wheel well as flight KQ-100 waited on the runway in Nairobi. The clattering of footsteps on metal stairs as passengers boarded the plane. The plane taxiing toward the runway. A pause and then the drone of Rolls-Royce engines attacking asphalt at 180 miles per hour. The plane picking up speed, the noise intensifying into the pneumatic whine of 1,000 dentist drills. Liftoff. A whip of wind, an icy chill, up to 10,000 feet, 20,000 feet, 35,000 feet. Colder and colder, unconsciousness, oblivion. He was buried in Lambeth Cemetery on February 26, 2020. It was a beautiful morning, clear and freezing cold. As workers prepared to lower the body into the ground, a solitary mourner panted into view. An official from the Kenyan embassy, dressed in a black suit and leather shoes, barely making it in time. The workmen lowered the coffin into the ground and inclined their heads for a few seconds. On the coffin was a metal plaque reading, "Unknown male, died 30th June 2019, age 30. When the body was in the ground, the embassy worker spun on his heels and hurried away. I looked at the grave. A nameless man lay before me in a little plot of southwest London, in an unmarked grave, identifiable only by a simple wooden cross and a numeric code. There are so many people like him. The horror of the Kenya Airways stowaway's death made for newspaper headlines. But many more migrants die in equally horrific circumstances every week. They keep quiet counsel in unvisited graves, and their stories vanish with them. This was adapted from a story that was first published in The Guardian. Pick up a couple of the health and science pieces this week. Africa's earliest burial. Archaeologists have found the oldest known human burial site in Africa, that of a child, probably a boy, who died 78,000 years ago. The remains, so fragile they had to be encased in plaster to be removed, were found in the Panga Ya Saidi cave near Kenya's coast. The child, who was about 3 years old, appears to have been carefully placed in a pit and then covered up with sediment from the cave floor. The positioning of the bones indicate the child was buried on its side with its legs drawn up to its chest and that its head may have rested on some kind of pillow. The fact that the spine hadn't collapsed during decomposition suggests the body may have been wrapped in a shroud. The burial takes us back to a very sad moment, one that despite the vast time separating us, we can understand as humans. Principal investigator Nicole Boyven from the Max Planck Institute in Germany tells The Guardian, older human burial sites have been discovered outside Africa, even though the continent was the birthplace of Homo sapiens. Researchers think this merely reflects where the most research has been done to date, and that older graves in Africa are likely waiting to be discovered. COVID-sniffing bees. Scientists have devised an innovative way to test for COVID-19, reports the Washington Post, getting bees to sniff it out. The idea came from a Dutch startup that had been training the odor-sensitive insects to detect mineral-rich ore and landmines. For the latest project, researchers cooled down 150 bees to make them less active, strapped the insects into harnesses, and then used a Pavlovian conditioning method to teach them the unique scent of the coronavirus. Each time the bees were exposed to a virus-positive test sample, they were also given a delicious sugar water solution, which the bees drank by extending their tongues. When they were given a negative sample, they received no reward. Within hours, the bees were sticking out their tongues when presented with the virus, even when no sugar water was offered. The researchers think the bees could be used in low-income countries with limited access to sophisticated testing technology. If this is going to work, said lead researcher Wim van der Poel, it can be very fast and very cheap. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. We have an article here titled, UFOs, What If They're Real? Unidentified flying objects have accomplished an extraordinary feat, said Marek von Rennenkampf in TheHill.com. They've created agreement between former Trump administration intelligence official John Ratcliffe and former Obama administration CIA director John Brennan. Both men say there have been scores of credible sightings of UFOs and that, in Brennan's words, they may be piloted by a different form of life. After years of dismissing UFO sightings as the delusions of tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists, Pentagon officials are acknowledging that military pilots have repeatedly seen flying objects shaped like Tic Tacs, inverted pyramids, and an acorn, behaving in inexplicable ways, whizzing around at incredible speeds, stopping and turning on a dime, diving into the ocean. In June, U.S. intelligence agencies are finally expected to issue a report detailing what the government knows about unidentified aerial phenomenon. The government isn't going to announce that UFOs are filled with little green men, said Gideon Lewis Krause in The New Yorker, but it is dropping the taboo on the topic and admitting that there are things it simply cannot figure out. Obviously, all this is a little weird, said Ezra Klein in The New York Times. But let's say that we do eventually get evidence that there is intelligent extraterrestrial life, either via UFO or an interstellar communication. Conspiracy theorists would see it as proof the government has been lying all along. Militaries across the world would see the existence of aliens as a threat, justifying massive new military spending. Perhaps it might even unite mankind, making our superficial differences seem trivial. One way or another, the knowledge we are not alone would upend how humanity understands itself and our place in the cosmos. Most scientists and academics remain skeptical that UFOs are alien craft, said Rizwan Burke in NBCNews.com. But now that the government is starting to take UFOs seriously, it's time for scientists to join a concerted effort to figure out what these objects are. After next month's report, the public may demand it, said C. Moon Reed in the Las Vegas Sun. It's maddening to learn that UFOs exist without also learning what or who they are. Are they just visual illusions? Extraterrestrial? Friendly? Hostile? It's time we made a serious effort to find out. And we'll pick up a few of the shorter notes. Americans will eat 224 pounds of red meat and poultry per person this year, including 58 pounds of beef, according to USDA projections. Plant-based meat substitutes currently account for less than 3% of the nation's packaged meat sales, and only about 5% of Americans identify as vegetarians. San Francisco may be approaching herd immunity after 75% of eligible adults have gotten at least one vaccination shot. California now has the lowest infection rate of any state. The Biden administration has approved the nation's first large-scale offshore wind farm, with construction to begin as soon as later this year. The Vineyard Wind project will site 84 turbines 14 miles off the Massachusetts coast and create enough electricity to power 400,000 homes. On the Poll Watch, we have 77% of Americans plan to travel this summer, a stark turnaround from last June when just 29% planned a trip. That was from a Harris poll. And we'll finish the show with a quote from Jerry Seinfeld. He's quoted in the Montreal Gazette. And he says, "You know you're getting old when you get that one candle on the cake. It's like, see if you can blow this out." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. That's 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.